As you've grown accustomed to my presentations over my 34 years in South Florida newscasts, I am here to tell you that I am not sure I can do that this year.
Well, that's troubling and interesting.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, thanks.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA, and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-round swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Glad to have you here. Okay, let's start here. Hi, Desi Doyen. We'll start there.
That's a good place to start.
Well, it always is. I usually try to avoid falling into what I'll call sort of these news honey traps, so to speak.
Yes.
But this one, I got to say, is just too sticky to avoid at least mentioning. Elon Musk, as he has been pretending, I should say, to leave the Trump administration after wrecking huge swaths of the federal government and leaving behind a wasteland of corruption and fraud and abuse and, yes, death around the world, the specifics of which I hope to get to in more detail as the week moves on. But with Elon's companies tanking because everyone hates him since his turn to the far neo-Nazi right, he's now apparently attempting to put some distance between himself and the Trump administration. With news now breaking on Tuesday afternoon that Musk is speaking against the Trump Republican so-called big beautiful bill that would, if passed in the same form it passed out of the House by a single vote, it would cut about $1 trillion from Medicaid and food nutrition assistance. It would take health care away from about 14 million Americans, all in order to increase the national debt by about $4 trillion in order to pay for tax cuts to mostly very wealthy people and corporations. Sounds like a good plan. So in a comment, Musk posted to the social media site that he purchased and personally ruined. He said on Tuesday, he described the bill as a, quote, disgusting abomination. His full tweet was, quote, I'm sorry, but I just can't stand it anymore. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination. Shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it. So Donald Trump's entire legislative agenda, wrapped into one single bill, which he describes as the One Big Beautiful Bill, is, as his recent co-president and first buddy described it on Tuesday, quote, pork-filled and a disgusting abomination. Now, as I said, it's kind of a news honey trap. I might suggest you do not take anything too seriously that Musk says or does from here on out to try and separate himself from the Trump administration. Don't take any of it too seriously, because his personal fortune and his companies, frankly, are collapsing thanks to his public racist turn to the far MAGA right over the past year or so. He's in an emotional and perhaps drug-addled doom spiral, it seems, at this point. He's now apparently doing whatever he can to try and save himself or his personal reputation or his businesses or something. So I don't know how you feel. I don't suspect he actually has much of a problem at all with Trump's spending bill, and that much of this is really just a PR attempt to try to save himself.
Yeah, a PR rehabilitation tour.
Nonetheless, I don't think Donald Trump is going to like it very much that the bill that he has been championing, wrapping his entire legislative agenda into for his second term, I don't think he's going to like it being described as, quote, a disgusting abomination. So don't take any of this kabuki theater, this split between Musk and Trump too seriously as it unfolds, but still, it may be worth popping up some popcorn to enjoy in the coming days, because I don't think Trump's going to like it. We've got to get some relief somewhere, I think, so from all of these horrors, many of them caused by Musk himself. So enjoy it while you can. At the same time, let it be noted that Musk's so-called Doge project, pretending to cut waste, fraud, and abuse from the federal government, will likely end up costing the federal government more than it saved, as the Trump administration has to date, compared to this point in the Biden presidency, spent much more than the Biden administration did, even though they're supposed to be cutting all of this waste, fraud, and abuse. Musk revised his promise to cut $2 trillion of federal spending down to $1 trillion, and then he recently conceded, well, he was able to cut just $150 billion, which also appears to be a vast overstatement of Doge savings, which have been riddled with inaccuracies and errors since they started reporting their usually unlawful cuts to statutorily mandated government programs. And since the cuts they made were to programs and spending already appropriated by Congress, and thus unlawful to cut without approval from Congress, well, the Trump administration is now asking Congress to codify those Doge cuts by passing a so-called rescission bill that would codify the unlawful cuts into law. It would somehow sort of make them legal. Now, how much government spending are they hoping to rescind with that rescission bill to make Doge cuts official and legal? Well, the White House bill asks for cuts of $9.4 billion worth of cuts to the federal budget, which sounds like a lot, but compared to what Elon Musk said he was going to cut, it's $9.4 billion, not $9.4 trillion, not even the $2 trillion that Musk had promised to cut, or the $1 trillion that he later promised to cut, or the $150 billion that he claims to have unlawfully cut, but just $9.4 billion. That's it. That's what the Trump administration is hoping to save by officially codifying Doge cuts into law. Impressed? Hey, MAGA, if you haven't noticed yet, you've been had. We tried to warn you, but oh well, apparently you like being lied to. It must be a fetish of yours or something. That said, the gutting of the federal government will end up actually costing much more than that, it seems, in both money and certainly in lives. NBC6, Miami meteorologist John Morales made that more than clear during remarks over our public airwaves on Monday on NBC6 that I will play for you in full. He begins with some footage of his live local coverage of Hurricane Dorian back in 2019 as the powerful Category 5 storm, one of the most powerful ever recorded in the Atlantic, by the way, as it swept northward up the eastern coast of Florida, threatening catastrophic landfall. But for predictions from Morales and the National Weather Service at the time that the storm, as it moved up, would ultimately take a right turn to head off out into the North Atlantic and avoid a catastrophic landfall in Florida or elsewhere along the eastern seaboard. Morales, his segment on Monday night, begins with that footage of his coverage from back in 2019 before he then jumps in with a message for viewers watching today following the ongoing gutting of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, along with cuts to the National Weather Service and the National Hurricane Centers housed within it, etc. He posted this online, along with the comments, "Cuts have consequences, illustrated, as seen on TV."
Listen, I've been on this, you know, since 8 o'clock this morning on social media, and there is a lot of anxiety out there because you don't see it turning, right? When is it going to turn? John, it's not turning. It's coming straight to us. It's going to turn, all right? The turn was never forecast to be on Sunday. The turn isn't even on Monday morning. The turn will come Monday afternoon, Monday evening, into Tuesday. Remember that? That was about 6 years ago. That was Hurricane Dorian, as it was absolutely devastating the northwest Bahamas as a Category 5 sat over that region for 2 days. It was headed straight west. Lots of people in Florida were concerned the hurricane was heading here. And as you've grown accustomed to my presentations over my 34 years in South Florida newscasts, confidently, I went on TV and I told you, it's going to turn. You don't need to worry. It is going to turn. And I am here to tell you that I am not sure I can do that this year because of the cuts, the gutting, the sledgehammer attack on science in general, and I could talk about that for a long, long time, and how that is affecting the U.S. Leadership in science over many years, and how we're losing that leadership, and this is a multi-generational impact on science in this country, all right? But specifically, let's talk about the federal government cuts to the National Weather Service and to NOAA. Did you know that Central and South Florida National Weather Service offices are currently basically 20 to 40% understaffed. From Tampa to Key West, including the Miami office, 20 to 40% understaffed. Now, this type of staffing shortage is having impacts across the nation because there's been a nearly 20% reduction in weather balloon releases, launches, that carry those radio signs. And what we're starting to see is that the quality of the forecasts is becoming degraded. There's also a chance, because of some of these cuts, that NOAA Hurricane Hunter aircraft will not be able to fly this year, and with less reconnaissance missions, we may be flying blind, and we may not exactly know how strong a hurricane is before it reaches the coastline, like happened a couple of years ago in Hurricane Otis in Acapulco, Mexico. So I was asked to talk about this today. I'm glad I was. I just want you to know that what you need to do is call your representatives and make sure that these cuts are stopped.
Well, that was John Morales of NBC6 in Miami on Monday telling viewers what is actually going on, talking about the cuts, the gutting, the sledgehammer attack on science, specifically on NOAA and the National Weather Service, and that it will affect his ability that he's had for decades on air down there in South Florida to report what is going on, to give warnings to millions of people along the southeastern seaboard about the dangers they are facing.
And the dangers that they may miss warnings for
yep.
now after Trump and Doge and Elon Musk have destroyed the U.S. forecasting capacity.
As he already says, these forecasts are already degrading.
Must be terrifying to be along the Gulf Coast and, like you say, the eastern seaboard.
Yeah. Wow. But so credit also where it's due, by the way, not just to John Morales for telling that to viewers on the news on Monday, but also to NBC6 there in Miami for itself asking for him apparently to offer that segment to inform their local viewers, if you can imagine such a thing. It should not be an act of courage for a television news operation to do so, but apparently it now is in the Trump era. So thanks to both John Morales and NBC6 Miami there for actually educating and informing their viewers over our public airwaves about what is really going on in our country and our world right now. By the way, if Elon Musk was actually appalled by anything, if he truly thought that, you know, what the Trump administration was doing, if he thought it was a disgusting abomination, well, he would be citing the gutting of our National Weather Service because, you know what? He knows better. He knows better. The man who, to his credit, almost single-handedly made the electric vehicle industry a reality, credit where it was at least previously due. He knows the dangers that gutting NOAA and the National Weather Service will cause amid our ever-worsening climate crisis. Whether he's yet willing to admit that out loud or not these days and risk the right-wing fossil fuel-funded scam that pretends our climate crisis is a hoax, would hate to make them mad. Well, we'll see if he ever does that. I mean, he may be a right-wing coward and a loser, but he knows better. He understands this. He knows the very real dangers that we are now facing thanks to the gutting of science and the National Weather Service by the Trump administration and DOGE. And in addition to unlawful cuts made to foreign aid in his unlawful DOGE shutdown of USAID that's resulting in thousands of deaths around the world, he also knows the dangers of gutting our world-class climate and weather science and the threat that that now poses to this country. He knows about it. He just doesn't care. So, no. Don't buy his, you know, save his own ass, pretend apology tour that we will be seeing over the coming days from Elon Musk. But do feel free to watch Trump's head explode because of all of it in the meantime. Of course, it's not only the gutting of the National Weather Service that's going to cost lives. It's also Trump's attempt to shut down FEMA entirely and pass off its duties to states somehow, even though they are not equipped to deal with disasters the way the federal government is. So when natural disasters do hit, the federal government is no longer going to be there to help, at least if Trump has his way. And even if he doesn't have his way, the damage is still underway at FEMA as well anyway. Before we left for a few days off last week, we reported on the story of internal documents from FEMA warning that the Federal Disaster Agency was not ready for hurricane season, which began on Sunday, June 1. That, in the wake of Trump firing the acting director of FEMA just a week or two earlier, placed a guy who was placed into the role by Trump himself after that man had the temerity to honestly respond to a question during congressional testimony that, no, he did not agree that FEMA should be shut down and its duties handed over to states as Trump has called for. So that disagreement with the Trump plan to shut down FEMA, that did not go well. He was removed from the job, and a guy named David Richardson, a military guy with zero experience in disaster management or recovery, was tapped to head FEMA. And one of his first acts on the job was a warning threatening employees of FEMA that he would, quote, run over them if they did not toe the line.
So don't get in my way. I know all the tricks, okay? I know them from Lance Corporals. I know them from staff sergeants, lieutenants, federal employees, my own employees, and indeed myself, okay? I've played the games too. Obfuscation, delay, undermining. If you're one of those 20% of the people and you think those tactics and techniques are going to help you, they will not, because I will run right over you. I will achieve the president's intent.
Very inspiring. So that guy, that's the guy. David Richardson is his name. He's the new head of FEMA, who, by the way, he is also apparently serving at the same time as Trump's assistant secretary at DHS, at the DHS office for countering weapons of mass destruction.
Because they're so much alike.
And, you know, a lot of extra time when you're countering weapons of mass destruction, or a lot of extra time when you're running FEMA. I don't know. Anyway, that guy heading FEMA, according to Reuters on Monday, said that he did not even know there was a hurricane season, that such a thing existed, at least according to staffers still at the agency who heard his remarks. As Reuters reported in their exclusive, staff of the Federal Emergency Management Agency were left baffled on Monday, after the head of the U.S. Disaster Agency said he had not been aware that the country has a hurricane season, That according to four sources familiar with the situation. It was not clear to staff whether he meant it literally, as a joke, or in some other context. The U.S. hurricane season officially began on Sunday and lasts through November, Reuters notes. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecast last week that this year's season is expected to bring as many as 10 hurricanes. Now, that doesn't, of course, mean that they will all make landfall, but they certainly could, and some number of them almost certainly will.
It's a reasonable assumption, yes.
A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, which is now FEMA's parent agency, said later after Reuters' report that the comment was just a joke and that FEMA is in fact, prepared for hurricane season. You don't need to worry. But that is not what their own internal reports said just a week or so ago regarding their lack of readiness for hurricane season, as we reported at the time. As to whether Richardson was actually joking about not knowing there was such a thing as hurricane season in the U.S., Desi Doyen, do you believe him?
You know, I'm not sure. It's without having seen his expression, it would be difficult to tell. But seeing his photo, I'm going to guess he wasn't joking.
I suspect a lot of people are going to accept the idea that, oh, he was just kidding around. Of course he knows it's hurricane season. Of course, the military guy with no natural disaster experience, who ran an office, who still does, regarding weapons of mass destruction, tapped to suddenly run FEMA. Oh, he totally knew there was a U.S. hurricane season. Of course, he was totally joking.
It's probably not the right place or time to have a joke like that.
And, well, four staffers, at least, who heard him say as much, did not know that he was joking. We're not sure. So many folks may buy that he was joking. Maybe they're right. Maybe he was. On the other hand, don't forget, as reported just about 2 weeks ago by ABC News, the new head of Social Security says he had to Google the job when he was offered it. Frank Bisignano, a former Wall Street executive, said during a town hall with Social Security managers about a week and a half ago that he wasn't seeking a position in the Trump administration when he got called for the job. The newly sworn-in head of the Social Security Administration told agency staff that when he was first offered the job in the Trump administration, he was not familiar with the position, and he had to look it up online to figure out what he did. That according to audio tape of that meeting in which, frankly, he kind of sounds drunk. I don't know. But this is a part of that audio as obtained by ABC News.
And it's about Social Security. And I'm not looking for a job. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do? So I'm Googling Social Security, you know, one of my great skills. I'm one of the great Googlers on the East Coast. But that is the headline for the Post. Great Googler, Googler in chief. Chief and Googler, whatever. By the way, I like to have fun at work. You know, we're allowed to laugh. We're allowed to have fun. We're allowed to know each other's families. We're allowed to be normal. How's that? I'm like, what the heck's the commissioner of Social Security? First, nobody said we're calling you. It was about Social Security, so I'm trying to figure it out.
What the heck is the Social Security Commissioner? Said the Social Security Commissioner.
So I'm Googling Social Security. I'm one of the great Googlers on the East Coast. What the heck is Social Security? And I'm all right. You sound kind of drunk there. Oh, by the way, we're going to just have some fun here. It's Social Security. It's just family. So that guy's Trump's pick to head up the Social Security Administration with a $15 billion administrative budget overseeing payments of some $1.5 trillion in Social Security benefits, benefit payments each and every year. In that 90-minute call, ABC reports Bisignano sought to calm concerns about the future of the agency amid the recent leadership turnover there and scrutiny from Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE. He told the managers in the meeting that Social Security was, quote, not going away. He said, quote, this is America's, you know, safety net. It's not going away, he said. You know who wants me to tell people that? Guess, he said, the president. He said, drunkenly or otherwise. He continued, I've got notes about that. He told staffers, will the turmoil of the last 5 months end? Are you here to cause more turmoil, he said. I don't think it's the turmoil of the past 5 months, although I will be the fifth since, you know, November, right? He was referring to being the fifth person put in charge of SSA since Trump was elected in last November. So, yeah, that's Trump's pick to head the Social Security Administration. It's a $15 billion administrative budget, and it's a $1.4 trillion in critical social safety net payments to the elderly, to children, to the disabled each year. He hired that guy for that job. So do you think his pick to head up FEMA, a guy who was hired to shut the agency down, necessarily knew that there was such a thing called hurricane season in the U.S. before he took the job, even though it was just a week or two ago that he was hired for this job, just days before hurricane season was to begin this past Sunday? Well, we report, you decide. The DHS spokesperson responding to Richardson's comments about not knowing there was a hurricane season said under Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and Richardson's, quote, FEMA is shifting from bloated, DC-centric dead weight to a lean, deployable disaster force that empowers state actors to provide relief for their citizens, for state actors to do so. Richardson said during his briefing with staffers on Monday this week that there would be no changes to the agency's disaster response plans, despite having told staff to expect a new plan in May, the sources told Reuters. Now, last I checked, it is now June, unless the people that make my calendar are also just joking about that. Richardson's comments come amid widespread concern that the departures of a raft of top FEMA officials, staff cuts, and reductions in hurricane preparations will leave the agency ill-prepared for a storm season forecast to be above normal. Hurricanes, Reuters notes, kill dozens of people and cost hundreds of millions of dollars annually. In fact, billions these days. Across a swath of U.S. states every year, the storms have become increasingly more destructive and costly due to the effects of climate change. I'm happy to mention that Reuters noted that in their coverage. Richardson said during the briefing on Monday that he will not be issuing a new disaster plan after all because he does not want to make changes that might counter the so-called FEMA Review Council. Trump created that council to evaluate FEMA and decide how they're going to destroy it. In a May 15 town hall, Richardson said a disaster plan, including tabletop exercises, would be ready for review by May 23. Apparently, they weren't. Trump has said that FEMA should be shrunk or even eliminated, arguing states can take on many of the functions that FEMA currently handles as part of a wider downsizing of the federal government. About 2,000 full-time FEMA staff, one-third of its total, have already been terminated or voluntarily left the agency since the start of the Trump administration in January. FEMA recently sharply reduced hurricane training and workshops for state and local emergency managers due to travel and speaking restrictions imposed on staff, according to prior Reuters reporting. In other words, they can't give workshops to the state and local emergency managers who are supposed to take over all of the duties of FEMA. They can't give these workshops, explain to them how what they need to do, because apparently nobody is allowed in the Trump administration to speak for FEMA, at least without prior approval of their comments.
Sorry, kids, you're on your own. And by the way, I want to point out that they have a very wrong idea of how FEMA works. FEMA is actually in a supportive role to states. States control what and where disaster relief occurs. They ask for FEMA to come in and help them. They don't. The FEMA is not in control of it. So calling FEMA bloated is just somebody who doesn't understand how FEMA works.
Are you saying the guy who runs FEMA doesn't understand how FEMA works?
Yes.
Are you joking? We don't know if it's serious or not. Anyway, I'm sure this will all go well this hurricane season. Why worry? Desi will have more on this, albeit wrapped into about 6 minutes, a little bit later this hour in our latest Green News Report. So let's take a quick break here. And we will come back with some election and democracy news from, well, all over the world today. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I'm Desi Doyen. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So before our break last week, we had covered a number of elections with somewhat surprising results around the world in a number of nations. First in Canada and then in Australia. Elections were held after months of the Conservative parties and candidates in both countries appearing ready to sail to easy victories. And then Donald Trump happened, including his ridiculous trade wars and tariffs around the world, leading to, you guessed it, liberal victories for prime ministers in both countries, in which the Conservative candidate not only got trounced in both Canada and Australia, but lost his own local seat, his local election for his seat in Parliament in both cases. And it was a historical first, I believe, in Australia. And it was the first time that that has happened in decades in Canada. And all of this apparent reactions by voters to Donald Trump's actions in this country, harming conservative parties in both of those countries in the bargain. You're welcome. But in Poland, don't forget about Poland. In Poland, which held elections over this past weekend, well, the story was a little bit different in the closely divided nation, which elected a liberal prime minister as recently as 2023 after years of being led by the hard right. But that liberal prime minister, whose name happens to be Donald Tusk, he's still in charge of parliament. He's still the prime minister. But on Sunday, it was presidential elections, and a conservative populist who appears to have taken back control of the presidency in Poland, resulting in what is likely to be a split government there for a while. Poland has elected Karol Nawrocki, a conservative historian and staunch nationalist, as its next president in a closely watched vote that signals a resurgence of right-wing populism in the heart of Europe, as AP reported early on Monday following Sunday's elections. Nawrocki, who is set to take office on August 6, is expected to shape the country's domestic and foreign policy in ways that could strain ties with the EU in Brussels while aligning the Central European nation of nearly 38 million people more closely with the administration of President Donald Trump in the United States. Nawrocki's victory underscores the enduring appeal of nationalist rhetoric among about half of the country along the eastern flank of NATO, and the European Union and its deep social divisions. Well, that sounds familiar, don't it? The 42-year-old historian, who had no previous political experience, built his campaign on patriotic themes, traditional Catholic values, and a vow to defend Poland's sovereignty against the EU and larger European nations like Germany. His win also reflects the appeal of right-wing nationalism still across Europe, where concerns about migration, national sovereignty, cultural identity have led to surging support for parties on the right, even the far right in recent times. For example, in Germany, where Elon Musk aligned himself with the far-right neo-Nazi party there. As his supporters celebrate his win, those who voted for the defeated liberal candidate, which was Warsaw's mayor, worry that this is now going to hasten the erosion of liberal democratic norms in Poland. Quote, "Poland remains a deeply divided country," said the president of the Polish Institute of Public Affairs. Although, quote, "although the electoral turnout was the highest ever in history of presidential elections, Mr. Nowacki's margin of victory is very small," he added, "which means that half of Poland will be cheering his presidency, whereas half of Poland, the other half, remains deeply worried or even disturbed." Again, sound familiar? Nowacki's presidency presents a direct challenge to Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, who returned to power in late 2023, pledging to mend relations with the EU. But Tusk's coalition, a fragile alliance of centrists, leftists, and agrarian conservatives, has struggled to push through key promises, including a civil union law for same-sex couples and a less restrictive abortion law. Nowacki, who opposes those measures, well, he'll now have the power to veto legislation, complicating Tusk's agenda and potentially triggering political gridlock. Again, sound familiar? Poland and the U.S. are, of course, close allies. There are some 10,000 U.S. troops stationed in Poland. But Tusk and his partners in the past have been critical of Donald Trump. Nowacki, however, has a worldview that is closely aligned with Trump. Nowacki has voiced support for Ukraine's defense against Russian aggression. That's good, but he does not back Ukrainian membership in NATO, and he has questioned the long-term cost of aid, particularly support for refugees from neighboring Ukraine. While the president does not control day-to-day diplomacy, as the prime minister does, Nowacki's symbolic and veto powers could frustrate Brussels' efforts to bring Poland back into alignment with the EU, particularly on rule of law issues. So which direction that now moves? Well, that's going to be closely watched on both sides of the Atlantic and, of course, in Russia. Meanwhile, news of a sudden government shakeup in the Netherlands on Tuesday is perhaps even more difficult to read, I think, though it may offer some hope for opposition liberals there. Maybe. Populist far-right lawmaker Geert Wilders plunged Dutch politics into turmoil on Tuesday by withdrawing his party's ministers from the ruling coalition in a dispute over a crackdown on immigration. The remaining ministers will, for now, run a caretaker administration until new elections can be organized later this year. The decision means the Netherlands will have a caretaker government when it hosts a summit of NATO leaders in just 3 weeks' time, which, by the way, on Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, not a member of NATO, but he said he was invited to the summit and that he will be attending. So that should be interesting. In the meantime, Dutch Prime Minister Dick Schoof held an emergency cabinet meeting to discuss the crisis touched off by Wilders today. Schoof is a career civil servant who was handpicked by Wilders a year ago to lead the government and said that he had repeatedly told coalition leaders in recent days that bringing down the government would be, quote, unnecessary and irresponsible. Of course, unnecessary and irresponsible seems to be the slogan for so-called populist conservative movements around the world these days. No date for a new election has been set yet. It's unlikely before the fall. Wilders' announcement, his decision early on Tuesday, he announced, in fact, on Elon Musk's X site.
Of course he did.
Of course he did. That after a brief meeting in Parliament of leaders of the four parties that make up the fractious administration that has now apparently collapsed. He told reporters that he was withdrawing his support for the coalition and pulling his ministers out of the cabinet over its failure to act on his desire for a clampdown on migration. His sudden withdrawal from the government shocked his coalition partners, but apparently he's done this before, years ago, that he just, you know, leaves when he doesn't get his way. After years in the opposition, his party, Wilders' party, won the last election on pledges to slash migration. Last week, Wilders demanded coalition partners sign on to a 10-point plan aiming to radically slash migration because Wilders has become frustrated. It hasn't been happening enough or fast enough for him. He said at the time last week that if immigration policy is not toughened up, his party is, quote, out of the cabinet. And he apparently made good on that pledge on Tuesday. Caroline van der Plas, leader of the pro-ag populist farmers citizens movement that is part of the Wilders coalition, or at least was, said she was angry at his decision. Quote, he is not putting the Netherlands first. He is putting Geert Wilders first, she told a Dutch broadcaster. In the meantime, Frans Timmermans, the former European Commission climate chief, who now leads the main opposition bloc in the Dutch parliament, well, he welcomed the decision. He called for fresh elections as soon as possible, telling AP, quote, I think it's an opportunity for all democratic parties to rid ourselves of the extremes because it's clear that with the extremes, you can't govern. When things get difficult, they run away, he told the Associated Press.
Well, I guess Geert Wilders is finally realizing that, oh, yeah, it's easier to be in the minority. You don't actually ever have to govern or make decisions. You can just, you know, throw nasty words around and everybody loves you.
So quit, throw a tantrum and say you're unhappy with the way things are going. I'm leaving.
Taking my toys and going home.
When you actually, you know, can't govern and make the things happen that you want.
Because you failed.
Anyway. We'll see what happens there. That'll be interesting to watch. Nice that he is away from the levers of power, at least sort of, kind of, for the moment. So as I said, that may be better news for liberals. We shall see. In what I think is definitely better news for liberals, out of South Korea elections on Tuesday, after months of turmoil in that nation following a failed attempt by the ruling Conservative Party president last year to, well, declare martial law kind of out of nowhere. Well, as of Tuesday, a liberal lawyer has now ousted South Korea's troubled ruling party's presidential candidate in elections, ending months of political instability that began with a botched declaration of martial law, which we covered on this show at the time as it happened, as it came out of nowhere. Lee Jae-myung will be sworn into office on Wednesday after his conservative rival Kim Moon-soo of the People Power Party conceded the race. Congratulating Lee, the chair of his rival Democratic Party, Kim, said that he humbly accepted, quote, the choice of the people. Well, that's nice. Exit polls, which have been in line with previous elections, suggest that Lee, in fact, will defeat Kim by a whopping 12 percentage points. The election took place 6 months to the day after then-President Yoon Suk-yeol shocked the East Asian democracy of more than 50 million people by abruptly declaring martial law, citing threats from, quote, anti-state forces, you know, the deep state, and accusing the opposition-controlled parliament of paralyzing the government. That did not go well for him or for his party, apparently. His attempt to lock down parliament, you may remember, with members ordering members of the military, well, that was quickly undone because opposition members sort of climbed over the fence to get back into parliament, retook the building, as the troops there did little or nothing to stop them. Led by Lee, lawmakers then impeached Yoon. Lee now elected as president, but before that, he led an impeachment effort against Yoon back in December over the short-lived martial law order, after which South Korea was led by a series of acting presidents, hampering the nation's efforts at the time to deal with the Trump administration's 25% reciprocal tariffs and other levies. Referring to the martial law declaration in his speech, in a lesson about, in his victory speech, in a lesson that we may want to keep in our back pockets, by the way, in this country, Lee said that people had endured, quote, hardship and protested in the streets to prove that this country belongs to ordinary citizens, that all powers exercised by the president come from the people, and that such powers must be used solely for the betterment of the people's lives and the brighter future of our country, not for any private gain. Again, just keep that in your back pocket. The martial law episode in South Korea deeply unsettled the country, which spent decades under military authoritarian rule. Lee's vows to punish those involved in the martial law order have raised fears of further political turmoil. Nonetheless, he was easily elected anyway. So maybe don't be afraid of, you know, oh, it'll cause political turmoil.
To have accountability.
To have accountability, exactly. So Yoon is still standing trial on charges of insurrection. That must be nice. In South Korea, that is a crime that is punishable by death or life in prison. Go figure. As I said, keep all of that in your back pocket. We may need it. Keep it in your back pocket for now. It may come in handy down the road. At least I hope it does. Desi Doyen and the Green News Report is up next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back. Brad Cass, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Of course, that music can mean only one thing. Desi is here to scare the hell out of you. In our latest Green News Report.
So what is this summer expected to be like for us?
Forecasters predict abnormally hot and long summer for the U.S. Canada's wildfire season is off to a ferocious start. Plus,
90% of the village of Blatten has been wiped off the map.
Glacier collapses in Swiss Alps due to global warming.
All that collapse and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics analysis, and snarky comment.
Elon Musk, wow, big story today in the New York Times. It says his drug use was way more intense during the campaign than we realized. He's got to be the first person in the world to take ecstasy and be overwhelmed by a blissful feeling that made him want to fire everyone at the National Weather Service.
It happens. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we were off for a week. We are back, and summer is here.
It certainly is, and it's going to be a hot one, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
First, the Atlantic hurricane season officially started on June 1st, but Reuters reports that the new acting head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, who has no disaster management experience, told staffers in a briefing on Monday that he was not aware that the U.S. even has a hurricane season.
I guess he really does hire only the best people, eh?
With America's weather and disaster agencies in turmoil, forecasters are predicting a very active hurricane season ahead thanks to unusually warm ocean waters.
Wait, there's a hurricane season?
Surprise! NOAA's Climate Prediction Center forecasts that the U.S. will see overwhelmingly above normal heat this summer from coast to coast. That is bad news for public health, energy costs, drought, and wildfires. And it's not just the U.S. Parts of China are already seeing extreme heat. One province saw road surface temperatures reaching 150 degrees Fahrenheit last week. In northern Europe, commercial fisheries are grappling with an extreme marine heat wave. And in Canada, summer heat is already intensifying nearly 200 active wildfires burning out of control in western and central provinces, like Manitoba, now under a state of emergency with more than 25,000 people forced to evacuate.
And we are barely into June.
I know. And wildfire smoke from Canada is already reaching the U.S., triggering hazardous air quality alerts across upper Midwest states. Get ready for several more years of even more record-breaking heat.
Oh, I'm ready.
The planet's five-year forecast from the World Meteorological Organization and the UK's Met Office warns that there is an 80% chance that over the next 5 years, the world will see a new annual temperature record surpassing 2024 as the hottest year in recorded history. And they say it is also likely that the planet's average warming will exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels.
Mm.
And all of that heat is having an impact. Late last week in Switzerland, a mountain glacier collapsed, triggering a catastrophic landslide that destroyed the alpine village of Blatten, which had been evacuated thanks to scientists' warnings. Glaciologists say the landslide was likely, quote, a direct result of our warming climate, which is melting the permafrost that acts like cement to hold the mountain together.
And it fell apart, wiped out the town.
Yep. Geomorphology professor Stuart Lane, in an interview with France 24, warned that such glacier collapses and landslides are increasing in frequency around the world, and governments are not prepared.
And that requires a much more difficult process of thinking about land use zoning, of identifying where these risks are going to happen in the future. With climate change, we're going to see more of that.
Yeah, we're going to see much more of that. Only question is whether we'll have any scientists in our government to take any action on it.
A new study concludes that 40% of glaciers in existence today are very likely already doomed to melt away due to climate warming emissions from fossil fuels. However, the researchers concluded that slashing carbon emissions and limiting heating to the internationally agreed target of 1.5 degrees Celsius could save half of the world's glaciers.
Well, that's half good news.
In politics, the Republican-controlled U.S. House rammed through a deficit-exploding pending budget reconciliation bill that kills investments in rooftop solar, clean energy projects, manufacturing, energy efficiency incentives for everyday Americans and businesses, and much more. A new analysis this week concludes that if congressional Republicans do succeed in killing clean energy tax credits, it will raise the cost of energy for both consumers and industry, particularly energy-intensive sectors like iron, steel, and chemical manufacturing.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us, please, on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. So, knock me over with a feather. The cuts that the Republicans hope to do to clean energy is going to raise energy prices for everyone and help out the fossil fuel industry.
Yes.
Is that right?
And of course, that is what the whole purpose of
what?
It is, to help out the fossil fuel industry.
Who could have guessed it?
Which, by the way, has been receiving, the fossil fuel industry has been receiving taxpayer subsidies annually, permanently, since 1916.
Really?
Yes.
I was going to say decades.
Oh,
but
a century.
At this point, we're over a century.
Yes, we
are.
Wow,
since 1916. And how long has the renewable energy industry been receiving those annual subsidies?
Well, I think at most there might have been a few in the 70s during Carter, but since then, renewable energy tax credits, clean energy tax credits have all had to be continuously fought for and passed in Congress every 2 years or so.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So renewable energy has had subsidies for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
They have to fight for those. Meanwhile, the most profitable industry in the history of humanity, the fossil fuel industry, they continue to get free gifts from taxpayers each and every year.
Of course they
since do. Since 1916.
But, you know, the fossil fuel industry, they're just a baby industry. Someday they'll be big enough to stand on their own without help from the taxpayers.
Until then, we better pick winners and losers, and apparently the winners
are always the
fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
Go figure. All right. Anyway, thank you very much, Desi Doyen, and thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, or want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do so for free at bradblog.com, where there is, and hopefully never will be, a paywall. That is thanks to those of you who, just from the kindness of your own heart, hit one of those donate buttons to help us stay on your public airwaves and sound the alarms, as we have been now doing for, we're now in our 22nd year of sounding those alarms. Thanks to you. Hit a donate button at bradblog.com or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, or find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at The Brad Blog. You'll find Desi over there as well. She is Green News Report.
Please come by and say hi.
To her, not me. I got my own problems. Anyway, no, I say hi to me. That's fine. Is that it?
Yes, that's it.
All right, we're getting out of here. Thanks. That's it. We'll see you at all of the above until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.